has the highest positive and the lowest negative of any public figure or politician in the state.
An endorsement that could change the course of Alaska's tight Senate race. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 23rd. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, is Alaska the place to be as the planet warms?
Anyone who's here in Alaska, who pays any attention to it, we're seeing the extremes right now.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
U.S. Senate candidate Dan Sullivan has a new campaign ad featuring the person he hopes to call a colleague, Senator Lisa Murkowski. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, this ad may rise above the noise of the busy campaign season.
On the one hand, the 30-second spot is just a classic endorsement with Murkowski indoors looking straight at the camera.
I need a partner in the Senate who will work to advance Alaska's interests, not the Obama agenda.
Anchorage pollster Mark Helenthal says endorsements usually don't move voters, but this one is different because Lisa Murkowski is the most popular person in Alaska.
She has the highest positive and the lowest negative of any public figure or politician in the state.
Helenthal also thinks the ad will be effective because Sullivan was a relative unknown in Alaska as recently as a year ago.
So people, rather than just getting their information from Sullivan's TV ads, now have Sullivan's now been sponsored by somebody that they have a long history with, Lisa Murkowski.
Helenthal says it could tip the scales because even among Democrats, Murkowski ranks just a hair below incumbent Senator Mark Begich in popularity.
We've got basically a dead heat between Begich and Sullivan, so 1-2% can be the difference in election.
The Begich campaign responds that despite what Murkowski says, she and Begich voted the same way 80% of the time in the first half of the year and 60% of the time during all the years they've served together. Begich campaign spokesman Max Crows sent a long list of issues where Begich and Murkowski are aligned. Both senators, for instance, support legal access to abortion, raising the federal minimum wage, and legalizing gay marriage. Sullivan has opposed all three. But whatever their differences, Murkowski is standing with Sullivan.
Alaska needs Dan Sullivan.
While she told Begich this summer to stop using her picture in his campaign ads. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A bill that will exempt tribes from taxation on social welfare programs has made its way through Congress and is awaiting the president's signature. The bill was introduced in response to the Internal Revenue Service's increased auditing of tribes over the last few years and is part of a national initiative to give tribes the same tax status as local and state governments. KTOO's Jennifer Canfield has more.
John Dossett, an attorney for the National Congress of American Indians, says this whole thing started in 2005 when the IRS Tax-Exempt and Government Entities Division went to the National Indian Gaming Commission and got a list of its tribal members.
They started at the top with the most wealthy tribes, and they started auditing them in around 2005. And then they started working their way down the list.
While some of the larger tribes complained about the audits, it wasn't until smaller, less wealthy tribes started getting audited that the NCAI started looking into the issue. Dossett notes one of the most egregious examples was when the IRS went after the Oglala Sioux tribe. The IRS expected families to claim charity, such as $200 vouchers to buy their children new school clothes, as income on their individual tax forms.
It's ridiculous. It's absolutely off the Richter scale, ridiculous. And then when they started doing that kind of stuff, that's when it just lit the tribes up.
To be clear, the IRS was targeting tribal general funds. So if a tribe was operating a social welfare program with its own money, the IRS wanted those benefits to be taxed. If a tribe was operating a program funded by the federal government, that was okay. In Alaska, native interests in oil, timber, or other business investments are most often held by the corporations. In turn, most tribes have little, if any, general funds and instead operate most of their services with federal funding. Still, Dossett brought a warning to last year's Alaska Federation of Natives convention in Fairbanks. He told delegates that the same IRS division that had been under fire for targeting Tea Party and conservative groups was also targeting tribes. While the IRS does not disclose who it audits, there haven't been any publicized reports of Alaska tribes subjected to the targeted audits. Despite that, tribes like the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes have become involved in the NCAI's Intertribal Organization Tax Initiative, which seeks to put Alaska Native and American Indian tribes on a level playing field with local and state governments.
We need to be one to be on par with state and local governments.
That's Will Micklin, a vice president with Tlingit and Haida.
And two, we need access to capital to monetize tax credits that would allow us to operate those economic ventures that would generate those general funds or enterprise funds that we could use for our own purposes to supplement the decreasing federal funding.
Micklin is also the executive director of the California Association of Tribal Governments. He says numerous tribes in California were subjected to the IRS audits.
It was burdensome, it was unproductive, and it was resulting in hardship both on the tribes as well as the tribal citizens.
In June, the IRS issued formal instructions on how to deal with tribal welfare programs. It essentially gave tribes the benefit of the general welfare doctrine, which allows federal, state, and local governments to operate tax-exempt social programs. Despite the change in IRS regulation, the Tribal General Welfare Exclusion Act of 2013 passed both the House and the Senate last week with strong bipartisan support and numerous co-sponsors, including all of Alaska's congressional delegation. Dossett says key elements of the legislation include the temporary suspension of the targeted audits and a mandate for IRS field officers to receive training in federal Indian law. But he hopes that training includes tribal representatives.
That's one of the things we're really advocating for, that it isn't just like a bunch of IRS agents going in a room and talking to themselves, but that, you know, that the tribes are involved and they bring in key people who know what's going on, and that there's a lot more really consultation between the IRS so that they can better understand what the tribes are doing.
The bill also establishes a tribal advisory committee within the Treasury that will advise the Secretary on Indian tax policy and authorizes the secretary to waive any penalties or interest imposed on tribal governments or members. The bill allows tribes to file claims for any taxes or fines imposed on its social programs in the last 3 years and directs the secretary to resolve any ambiguities in the act in favor of tribal governments. Another bill that NCAI advocated for through its initiative, the Tribal Tax and Investment Reform Act of 2013, would have allowed tribes to issue tax-exempt bonds for community infrastructure. The bill is in a House committee and has no companion bill in the Senate. With Congress in recess until November, it's unlikely to advance. In Juneau, I'm Jennifer Canfield.
The owner of a Wasilla disability clinic has been charged with Medicaid fraud. The Alaska Department of Law filed charges against Laura Sassine, owner of the Matsu Activity and Respite Center, LLC, on Monday, alleging falsification of business records and misdemeanor medical assistance fraud. The center, known by its acronym MARC, was shut down in June of this year amid an investigation. State Assistant Attorney General Andrew Peterson with the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit said there are two suits against Sassine, a civil suit regarding the overpayments and a criminal suit regarding the falsification of records. A state audit conducted in 2012 showed that MARC documents had been modified by changing hours and types of service. Auditors found that MARC billed Medicaid close to $2 million in 2009, reaping overpayments that year of $705,000. The state wants to recover that amount. Peterson says Sassine was the only person to benefit from the overcharges. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, students in Juneau work to make sense of the political process.
We were kind of like, this is interesting. We don't even know what they do. Like, and I'm 18. I can vote now. What is this?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The National Snow and Ice Data Center this week announced Arctic sea ice reached its minimum extent on September 17th. It's the sixth lowest sea ice extent since scientists began keeping records back in 1979. Ice extent was measured at 1.94 million square miles. According to the NSIDC, this year's sea ice minimum is below the long-term average, but the measurement is still a preliminary measurement. Changing winds still have the potential to push the ice extent lower. The NSIDC says it's still too soon to tell whether the sea ice surrounding Antarctica has reached its maximum winter extent. However, sea ice in Antarctica has been recorded above average in almost all sections of that continent this year. Scientists expect to announce the Antarctic maximum sea ice extent and official Arctic sea ice minimum sometime in October. Alaskans stay in Alaska. That was the first line of this morning's most emailed story in the New York Times, which looked at which U.S. cities are likely to be most hospitable in a changing climate. KSKA's Monica Gokey looked into the science behind the story and has this report.
Hurricanes, floods, droughts, and wildfires, not your thing? Go north, climate research says. It might sound like a no-brainer to some, but the idea got a lot of play in the media after a New York Times article pegged Alaska as one of the best places to live as global climate warms.
If you don't want your climate to change, Anchorage is probably the place that you would like to be.
That's Camilo Mora, the University of Hawaii geographer behind the research. It's not that Anchorage climate won't warm up. Mora says it will. It's just not forecasted to change as drastically and as soon as a lot of other parts of the world. Last year, Mora was the lead author on a well-publicized study in Nature that identified the year 2047 as a climate tipping point for U.S. cities on average. Anchorage, by contrast, wasn't forecasted to reach its tipping point until the year 2071, according to Mora's research. While the margin of error is pretty high for some of these models, what is not in doubt is the fact that climate is warming, Mora says.
The temperatures that you have been used to for the last 200 years are going to be acting on the past.
University of Alaska biology professor Doug Causey says there's more to the story. Temperature is one of the easier metrics of climate change to latch onto. And yes, temperatures are warming, by and large. But he says thermometers don't illustrate the big picture, especially not in Alaska.
Just talk about the terrestrial environment, soil erosion. Talk to the folks in Newtok about what they're experiencing, you know, as they watch their town wash away, or Shishmaref. People who are used to hunting and fishing at nearby ponds, they're drying up. The permafrost has melted, and so all the waters are draining out of the ponds. Not everywhere and not all of them, but these are the dramatic changes that we're seeing.
Causey says, yes, Alaska is cold, but it's not exactly a get-out-of-jail-free card when it comes to climate change.
Anyone who's here in Alaska who pays any attention to it, we're seeing the extremes right now. Rain in the interior. I mean, Fairbanks was like wetter than Ketchikan or something like that. I mean, it was just insane. Fireweed is starting to bloom in July.
Back in Hawaii, the researcher behind the New York Times article says he's never been to Alaska. Mora says his research is mostly model-based. The regions that ranked high for livability in a warming climate, he says, are the places that are used to change.
Alaska, from the biological perspective, is going to be, in our opinion, is going to be resilient. Alaska, many other places that already are at high latitudes, they are used to a high climate variability.
He points to himself as an example. Morris says he's originally from the tropics, moving to a place where the temperature changes wildly from one season to another, like Alaska, would be a big change for him. So is Alaska really the Florida of the future? Morris says he's not looking into the move just yet. For now, he's putting his money into another air conditioning unit in Hawaii over a plot of land in the last frontier. In Anchorage, I'm Monica Gokey.
Jurors have reached a not guilty verdict on the most serious charges against two men accused of murdering a co-worker at an Unalaska fish plant in 2012. But as KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports, the jury couldn't agree on every count.
On Monday afternoon, jurors found 36-year-old Leonardo Bangalto Jr. and 42-year-old Denison Soria not guilty of two counts of second-degree murder each. One count included intent to cause serious injury, while the other was tied to an extreme indifference to human life. Bangalto from Maple Valley, Washington, and Soria from Unalaska were accused of beating Jonathan Adams to death outside a Bering Fisheries bunkhouse in February 2012. But the jury couldn't decide if either man was guilty of assault, manslaughter, or several other charges. Judge Patricia Douglas declared a mistrial on those counts that could set the stage for a brand new trial process starting later this year. In all, the jury deliberated for about 11 hours after hearing more than a week of testimony from an eyewitness, a bunkhouse neighbor, and several police and medical officials involved in the case. Attorneys showed the jury photos of Adams' injuries and the bunkhouse deck where he was found the night of his death. The jury also listened to recordings of the eyewitness's call to public safety and first responders' attempts to revive Adams at the scene using CPR. Bangalto and Soria both declined to give their own testimony. They spoke and listened through Tagalog interpreters during the trial. In closing arguments last Thursday, Assistant District Attorney James Fayette told the jury the alleged fight was the result of Bangalto and Soria's pre-existing aggression toward Adams and that the fight had directly caused Adams' death. But defense attorneys said Fayette hadn't proven either of those things. They questioned the reliability of the state's witnesses and argued that neither man had set out to seriously injure Adams when the altercation began. Jurors were asked to consider each man's charges separately, and Soria's attorney, Paul Maslakowski, argued in particular that his client was barely involved in the fight. The eyewitness who testified called Leonardo Bangalto the primary aggressor, but Bangalto's attorney, James Ferguson, called Adams' death an accident resulting from horseplay. Jurors reached their not guilty verdicts on the murder charges around 5 p.m. on Monday. Before dismissing them from service, Judge Douglas thanked the jury for participating in what she said was an unusually difficult trial. The state now has the option to pursue a retrial for any or all of the remaining charges in the case. Attorneys will decide how to proceed at a scheduling conference in November. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek with help from Lauren Rosenthal.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at Doyon.com.
As high school seniors in Juneau turn 18, some are starting to take a real interest in how the capital city is run. Last week, a Thunder Mountain High School class took a field trip to a Juneau Municipal Candidate Forum, where they posed questions to the candidates. KTOO's Lisa Fu reports on what the students want to know.
These were a few of the questions asked by high school seniors.
What was the reason for building the Auk Bay Roundabout?
Why did we build another library next to Thunder Mountain?
This is a question for the school board candidates. Why does high school start so late in the morning, and what are the benefits of that versus an earlier start?
Coming up with questions was a homework assignment. But before the students could do that, they first had to answer this question in class. What is the Juneau Assembly?
We have no idea. We were like, it's a bunch of people who do stuff.
Student Sarah Morris says she and her classmates were stumped.
We were kind of like, this is interesting. We don't even know what they do. Like, and I'm 18. I can vote now. What is this?
Sarah says some students turned to their phones. Their teacher gave them her definition, and then the class had a discussion.
And then we just came up that they make laws for Juneau.
Now that Sarah has some idea of what the assembly is, she does have some concerns.
The garbage dump is just horrible, and I just am like, why is it that way? And I really think that everybody has really positive opinions about it, that it needs to be changed, and just how that needs to be done, I still want to know.
Classmate David Wolf didn't get a chance to ask his question.
I wanted to ask if they see the amount of personnel they have in the government as all essential. I feel like a lot of expenses going towards hiring people, and we don't need as many people in the government system as we do.
For the school board, Sarah wonders this about Thunder Mountain High School.
Why don't we have a nurse there full time? I think that's really important. I mean, like, everybody's really concerned about the health of the students, but yet there's no nurse there. You know, like, you go at the beginning of the day and they're like, can I get some ibuprofen? Oh, the nurse isn't here.
Overall, the students were happy they went to the forum. So was teacher Mara Early.
I'm just really excited that they got to come and merge what they learn in the classroom with real life politics in the community.
Chloe Varner is student body president at Thunder Mountain. She says she's long been intrigued with politics, but only recently has become interested in what's happening on the city level.
I just turned 18, so now I get to vote and I get to put my voice out there. I'm just starting to like pay attention, like what's going on. I took notes and I'm getting a better idea of who I'm going to vote for.
Now the students can focus on their next assignment during this election season. In pairs, the students are researching a real candidate in the municipal or general election and playing the role of that candidate's campaign manager. The students will develop a campaign strategy, advertisement material, and write a speech. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
What are the arts worth in Southeast Alaska? A new economic study says painting, carving, music, and other creative pursuits generate at least $60 million a year in business. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the details.
If you know 35 or so Southeast Alaskans, odds are that you know an artist. That's according to a new study that surveyed the region's artists, arts businesses, and organizations.
So really, when you're looking at saturation of artists in the region, we have nearly three times as many as the general U.S. population.
Melani Shivens is director of Juneau-based Rain Coast Data, which researched the arts economy for the Southeast Conference. She estimates 2,340 artists live and work in the region. Many do it part-time, but their hours add up to the equivalent of 2.5% of the workforce.
Last year, Southeast Alaska artists earned nearly $30 million just from the arts components of their job. And so to put this in context for a second, in terms of workforce earnings, the arts sector is nearly twice the size of the regional timber industry.
It's also about the same size as Southeast's financial sector, which includes banks, investment firms, and so on. Shivan says about 1 in 10 of those surveyed make their entire living in the arts. About 6 in 10 earn less, and some don't make any money at all.
30% of the artists in the region, while accepting money for their work, are actually losing money as a whole. So nearly a third of the artists are actually spending more in terms of investing in their artwork than they get paid for doing their art.
Total regional arts revenue adds up to almost $60 million a year. That includes spending by artists, customers, organizations, and audience members.
It stimulates business activities, it generates tourism revenue, it attracts and retains a high-quality workforce here. People come here because of our arts community and the arts that our region has to offer. They stay here because of that, and it boosts quality of life.
Shivan says her research shows that Tlingit, Haida, and other Alaska Native artists make more money. Twice as many, just under 20%, generate all their income from the arts. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Sunday marked the beginning of Banned Books Week. As APRN's Dave Waldron reports, at an Anchorage library, the celebration involves more than just literature.
Stacia McGordy is a librarian working at Anchorage's Lusac Library. She says this week is a huge deal for her profession.
Banned Books Week is a national holiday for librarians.
And that's because Banned Books Week is all about celebrating the freedom to read what we want. It's also a way to bring to light the banned books of past and present. McGordy says more books get challenged than banned these days. The challenges, which are the first step of banning, usually come from school districts.
Because it's geared towards children, and a lot of the challenges come because people believe that the material is not appropriate for that age level or that grade level.
Some of the most banned books in school libraries are classics, like To Kill a Mockingbird and Of Mice and Men. But McGordy says the most commonly banned book is one you likely haven't heard of, unless, of course, you're the parent of a 10-year-old boy.
Captain Underpants is probably number one. It is a elementary age graphic novel, and it's basically a superhero cartoon. I haven't read this particular book, but it is super popular. It's been popular ever since I was in college working in the bookstore, and it's popular now. You still have kids asking for it.
Captain Underpants aside, McGordy says these banned and challenged books are usually serious and sometimes absurd censorships.
In 1987, Anchorage School District banned a dictionary for having slang definitions for certain words.
McGordy says banning a book in a public library is much harder than doing it in a school, but it does happen. She says anyone can try to ban a book.
Every library has their own process. In ours, you would fill out a comment sheet. It would go to the director. You have to, you know, be very specific in why you think it needs to be taken off the shelves. You can't just take things out of context. You actually have to read the entire book. And it's a lot harder in a public library than it is a school library because we are the library of the people.
McGordy says most people at her library bypass the banning process and take their censorship into their own hands.
You have plenty of people who, you know, check out a book and then just never return it because they don't think anyone else needs to have that book. Or you have people who return it, but they've blacked out certain things. There is a picture book called In the Night Kitchen by Maurice Sendak, who you probably remember from Where the Wild Things Are. But there is a picture of a little boy, and he just happens to be naked in the kitchen. And sometimes people draw a little, you know, bathing suit or something on a little boy.
McGordy says you might be tempted to think that if a little vandalism is the worst that's happening, and if most of these challenges don't end in actual bans, why make such a big deal about Banned Books Week?
I think it's important because, first of all, you should be aware of the fact that you have the freedom to read and explore the ideas that you want. I mean, you think about China and how they block certain Google searches. So it's not just books. It's really about protecting ideas and protecting access to information because libraries really offer free and equitable access to information and a place for the community to come together and learn.
For APRN, I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jennifer Canfield, Lisa Fu, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Monica Golke in Anchorage, and Annie Ropeek in Unalaska. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson project, proving energy lives here. And by Nano Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.